Good evening, Erev Tov. Welcome to Torah Tuesday. This is the week of Parashat Vayechi, which is the last portion in the book of Genesis. Vayechi just means, and he lived. You can kind of see the word for life, chai, contained within there. It's covering Genesis chapter 47, verse 28. Through the end of the book, which is chapter 50, verse 26. We'll spend some time looking at that. I'll break down a little bit more about what we're going to focus in on this evening. You'll get bang for your buck, I promise. I think it has their record as the most commentary I've written for Torah Tuesday, and yet it's covering the fewest number of verses. And that's with whittling stuff out. But we'll talk a little more about that in a minute. Let us begin with a blessing before the study of Torah, as well as our binding and joining ourselves to our Messiah, Yeshua. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech ha'olam asher kidishanu b'mitzvotav v'sivanu le'esok b'divrei Torah. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who has sanctified us with his commandments, and has commanded us to be engaged with the words of Torah. Haureini machasher atzmi ba'adon Yeshua ha-Mashiach ha-Zadik. Shehu lechem ha-chaim v'ha-or ha-amiti. Mapsi teshuat olamim l'kol shamav. We hereby join ourselves to the Master, Yeshua, the Messiah, the Righteous One, who is the bread of life, the true light, the source of eternal salvation for all of those who hear him. Amen. If you haven't done so, please grab a handout at the end of the table. It is front and back even this evening. Yes, that's right. I'm telling you. We're going to look briefly at our Hebrew lesson, as they all have been in our Shadows of Messiah series, coming from the Apostolic Scriptures. This will be coming from Revelation chapter 5, verse 5. And not only did I choose it because of the obvious reason after we translate it, and I kind of introduce what we're going to talk about tonight, but it also has a nice, important verbal tally that's dedicated to an entire section this evening. So, nice verbal tally that Yochanan does there in Revelation that we'll talk about. But the text reads that we're translating of Revelation 5, verse 5, Hine gavar ha'aria meshevet Yehuda. So hine is just the Hebrew word that usually would in the King James be translated as behold or lo. It's just kind of an attention grabber word, meaning this is important, heralding kind of word. So behold, gevar, related to gabor, great, big, awesome, spectacular. Ha-aria. Aria is the Hebrew for lion. So the lion with the definite article. So behold, the great big lion. Meshevet. The mem, the m, is the preposition from. And shevet, we're going to translate it here as tribe. But that's the word, that's the verbal tally word we're actually going to dedicate a whole section to a little bit later on. Because it means more than tribe. It has to do with staff and rod and authority, just a whole bunch of, it's a really pregnant word. But for our purposes here, we're going to go with tribe. So behold, the big old lion from the tribe of Yehuda, Judah. So behold the big lion from the tribe of Judah. Hine gavar ha'aria mishavet Yehuda. So let us read together. Here we go. Hine gavar ha'aria mishavet Yehuda. All right. Very good. Very good. So the opening line of this week's parashat of Vayiki, Genesis 47, verse 28, reads, Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. Now, If that's all I told you, how would you know that they were good years for Jacob? The Hebrew word for good is tov, and tov adds up to 17. Goes back all the way to when it talked about Joseph being 17 years old and so forth. Talked about. So Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So not only on a Peshat level did he live there 17 years, it's actually letting us know what kind of years they were. They were good years. So the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. So this, the final portion from Genesis, begins with the words, Jacob lived. Vayechi. Jacob is the he and he lived. Jacob lived. But it's actually Jacob's death, which this portion is largely concerned with. It deals with the details of inheritance and blessing and the continuity of the covenant being passed from Abraham to Isaac, from Isaac to Jacob, from Jacob to his sons. But for our purposes tonight, since the theme of our time this year is the shadows of the Messiah, we're going to focus on Jacob's prophecies over his son Judah. In other words, in this portion, he gathers his children around and he blesses each one of them individually. We're only going to look at his blessing of Judah because this blessing has a direct bearing on the Messiah, and it contains numerous shadows of the Messiah. It's really just 5 verses that we're going to look at this evening with a bookend verse at each end, but largely just 5 verses. Genesis 49, verses 8 through 12. Those 5 verses, though, as I said, account for the longest Torah Tuesday commentary that I've written. The sages, and the reason why is the sages spend a lot of time on these 5 verses because they're messianic. They're universally messianic. They've always been understood messianically by everybody. And so it's one of the key places you look at when you want to find out what did the scriptures say and teach about the Messiah. And so throughout the evening, I'm going to be pulling in a lot of the commentary from the sages and how they help us have insight into it. And also this evening, it's really kind of dense, so it's not really sexy. Okay, but it's good. It's good stuff. It's just solid, solid stuff. Okay, in other words, it doesn't have a lot of bedazzle. I don't have anything to really bedazzle you with. I just have lots of data for you, okay? It's a data dump. Okay, so it's going to be worth re-listening to because it's going to be a long data dump. Okay? But it's a lot of stuff. So here we go. Let's get started. The bookend, Genesis 49, verse 1. Jacob says, "Assemble yourselves that I may tell you what will befall you in the days to come." I think a couple of years ago, the Torah Tuesday, I spent some time on this verse. It's a very mystical verse because Jacob here is actually having a vision in the future. He's seeing the days of Messiah. In fact, he sees the Messiah. And I commented on how he actually lets us know it was Yeshua and so forth. We won't really go there this evening. I may hint at it at the end, at the bookend. But it's important to note that's how it begins. He's assembling the children around, the sons of Israel, his children. And he says, "That I may tell you what will befall you in the days to come." So he's assembling his sons to give them his parting blessing, just as his grandfather Abraham had blessed Isaac, and then Isaac had blessed Jacob. In the Torah, it's important to remember that blessings are not just kind of well wishes. In our culture, we kind of just use a blessing to be kind of generic and wishing someone well. That's really not the role they play in Hebraic thought, and it's especially not the role that they play in the Torah. Blessings in the Torah always have prophetic significance. Blessings in the Torah are prophetic in nature. The blessings in the Torah will contain more than just a well wish. They will speak of destiny. They will speak of prophetic destiny. And so when Jacob has his children and he blesses them, he is actually instilling upon them their prophetic destiny. because he's had this vision, as he said in verse 1 of chapter 49. He's assembling and he's letting them know what will happen in the last days. And so he's setting for them their prophetic destiny. And so when he assembles his sons to bless them, he promises to reveal what will befall them in the days to come. The Hebrew that's behind the phrase days to come is akrit ha-yamim. Akrit is literally backside. Okay, the backside of the days. Okay, or you could translate that quite literally, the last days, the end days. And so Jacob's prophecy stretched all the way through history, the history of Israel, and all the way into the last days. That phrase, akrit ha-yamim, lets us know it means from the time he blessed them until there are no more days. His blessings are that length in its prophetic structure. And so as Jacob looks into the future to bless his sons regarding their destinies, he was actually seeking the Messiah and the age of redemption. Because the bookend that we're going to focus on at the end of this evening is Genesis 49, verse 18, when he says, "For your salvation I will wait, O Lord." So he begins it with, here's your destiny from now until the end of days. And then after he explains it all, he says, "For your salvation, O Lord, I long." And the word for salvation there is Yeshua. But we'll talk a little more about that later. And so though he pours out most of his lavish blessings over his favored son Joseph, and how he does that, remember Joseph is the favorite son, but showing favoritism kind of got it in all this mess, right? And so how is Jacob very Jacob-like in making sure Joseph gets a double portion of the inheritance? Oh, you've had two beautiful boys. Let me adopt them, and I will bless them and give them inheritance. Okay, so not only does Joseph get a blessing, but Ephraim and Manasseh get a blessing. So Joseph gets three blessings. Okay, very, very clever on Jacob's part to still show that favoritism, but without being so overt this time. But even though he shows this kind of blessing and favoritism towards Joseph, Jacob is still prophetically compelled to give the kingship to Judah. The blessing over Judah in Genesis 49, verses 8 through 12, or 8 through 11, depending on the text, is, again, what's going to require our attention this evening because they concern the Messiah in great detail. And we will essentially move through this blessing, these five verses, slowly, phrase by phrase. We're going to almost, but not quite, look at it word for word, seeking out the shadows of the Messiah and what will befall Messiah, as well as us, in the Akarit Hayamim, the last days. So that sets our course. So Genesis 49, verse 8, begins the blessing of Jacob to Judah. And he says, "Judah, your brothers shall praise you." So Jacob prophesies over his son Judah, saying that his brothers will praise him. The Hebrew word being used here is yada, translated most often in most English versions as praise. "Judah, your brothers shall praise you." It's also, though, commonly rendered elsewhere in the Old Testament when the translators want to translate it differently, the same word differently, as "give thanks" and "confess." And that's the meaning, I think, that carries pretty significant shadow. It carries the sense of making a verbal statement, whether it's a confession of sin, a confession of thanksgiving, a confession of praise, or some other verbal admission. Yada has the sense of a verbal confession. And therefore, the passage could easily be translated as, "Judah, your brothers shall confess you." And I think that will fit well with what we talked about last week, right? With the brothers of Joseph. And here you have the brothers of Judah will confess you. In the most literal sense, the pshat of the text, The implication is that the other tribes will have to acknowledge the headship, the kingship of the tribe of Judah. Judah here is being set out as being the king, the leader of the 12. The prophecy certainly had a fulfillment. Remember our Hebraic toolbox? Any prophecy, one, it always has multiple fulfillments. And any fulfillment of a prophecy does not exhaust it. And one of the more prominent ways that this prophecy for Judah, that his brothers would confess him and recognize his headship, has its fulfillment in the days of King David. Under the leadership of the Davidic house, the tribe of Judah ascends to a position of prominence over the other tribes. But from a messianic perspective, we know that one day the house of David will be restored in Judah through the Messiah king, Yeshua. And as the head of the tribe of Judah, he will be acknowledged by all his brothers. Again, as we discussed in last week's class. And that day, that last day, Jacob's prophecy will find a fulfillment where the brothers will confess the leader of Judah. But the prophecy finds more immediate fulfillment in the confession of faith spoken by followers even today. Rav Shaul, the Apostle Paul, regards the verbal confession of Yeshua as a criterion for salvation. Romans 10, verses 9 through 10. If you confess, and that's the Hebrew word yada, so if you yada with your mouth Yeshua as master, the Hebrew there is Adon, not Adonai. If you confess with your mouth Yeshua as master and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For with the heart a person believes, resulting in righteousness, and with the mouth he confesses, he yadas, resulting in salvation. And so the prophecy, the blessing of Judah begins pretty strong, that your brothers are going to confess you. And it's a kind of a loaded word. Not only are they going to confess you and recognize your leadership and your authority through your kingship, such as through David and through pretty much all the kings of Judah, but they will confess you the way we understand confess, specifically as it relates to salvation. And so his brothers will confess Judah. Continuing in verse 8, your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Here with that phrase, on the neck of your enemies, Jacob is assuring Judah that his descendants, the descendants of Judah, will prevail over their enemies. Again, the prophecy looks very much like it's pointing towards the Davidic monarchy. Through the conquest of David, the tribe of Judah put down the enemies of Israel on every side. David was that great king par excellence. Rashi explains the prophecy as being fulfilled in King David. This is Rashi's commentary on Genesis 49, verse 8. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. This refers to King David, of whom it says, quoting 2 Samuel 22, verse 41, you have also made my enemies turn the backs of their necks to me. So Rashi understood this to be referring to the Davidic monarchy. But when you understand Scripture from a fractal point of view and a cyclical point of view, every king of Israel, especially King David, anything said of King David is really said of King Messiah, right? Because all the kings of Israel, and especially David, are foreshadowings and types and fractals of the Messiah. And so what is said of one can be said of the other. So it's speaking of the Davidic monarchy? Of course it is. Of course it is. I mean, there's really no need to even try to deny it. It's quite obvious it is. But the Davidic monarchy is still just paving the way for the Messiah, the son of David. And so in the cyclical pattern of prophecy, so too in the future, the tribe of Judah will again prevail over its enemies. Messiah, the son of David, will fight on Israel's behalf and defeat her enemies. In popular kind of Jewish eschatology just being the fancy word for study of the end times and things, The wars of Messiah are commonly referred to as the Battle of Gog and Magog, which is derived from the apocalyptic-styled battles that are described in Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39. Those passages describe a confederation of nations that assemble, and they make a coalition. All the nations, I mean, see if you can, this sounds remotely familiar. All the nations get together and make a partnership against Israel. And they decide in the latter days not only to partner against Israel on a political and economic level, but to actually go ahead and make war. But God intervenes, and he comes to the assistance of his people by the Messiah, through the agency of the Messiah. And the sages identify that battle of Gog and Magog with the coming of the Messianic era. A quotation from the Talmud associates Gog and Magog with Messiah by linking the battle with the image of Psalm 2. This is from Tractate Berachot, Folio 7b. In regard to the war of Gog and Magog, it is written in Psalm 2, "Why are the nations in an uproar, and the peoples devising a vain thing? The kings of the earth will take their stand, and the rulers will take counsel together against the Lord and against his Messiah. In that day, the day of Gog and Magog, the hand of Messiah will be on the neck of his enemies, and every enemy will be defeated." And so, again, you have this blessing, which on its surface, your hand shall be on the neck of your enemy, simply saying, you won't be overcome. You'll be a king, you'll be a mighty king, you'll be a warrior king, you will defeat your enemies. And again, you kind of see that through that, but from a messianic point of view, it's pointing even beyond that until the time when the Messiah ushers in his kingdom. Continuing with verse 8, "Your father's sons shall bow down to you." Clever wordplay here that Jacob does. Jacob is just a really smart guy. Okay, you may not guess that by looking at that phrase, "your father's sons shall bow down to you." But if you look at how Abraham blessed Isaac and how Isaac blessed Jacob, you'll see how smart Jacob was. When Isaac blessed Jacob, he said to him, "May your mother's sons bow down to you." Genesis 27:29. When Jacob blesses Judah, though, he says, "Your father's sons shall bow down to you." So why does Jacob deviate from the pattern of blessing? Why doesn't he say, as was to his forefathers, "May your mother's sons bow down before you"? Got any ideas? Multiple wives, yeah. In Genesis Rabbah, the sages explain that since Isaac had only one wife, he was able to say, "May your mother's sons bow down before you." But since Jacob had four wives, the term "your mother's sons" would not include all of his children, and therefore his dominion, his authority, would not be over all of them. Therefore, in order to ensure that all the children of Israel, all of Jacob's children, are included, he says, "Your father's sons shall bow down to you." So he carefully words the blessing to ensure that all of Israel was included in the bowing down before Judah. So he's very careful in how he chooses his words. This also can be applied messianically. In the future, all Israel will bow before Messiah, the king, who will rise from Judah. All the children of the fathers, whether those born naturally or those grafted in through faith, are to be included. And this is part of Paul in Romans 11, verse 26, with all Israel will be saved. The sons of Yeshua's father shall bow down to him. But as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become the children of God, even to those who believe in his name. John 1, verse 12. Through faith in Yeshua, we as sons and daughters of the Father, we will bow before Yeshua in adoration and awe. So, verse 8, basically, of chapter 49 is a very powerful prophetic blessing of this immense lordship, powerful lordship. No one will overcome him. all his brothers will recognize who he is, that even all of Israel unite and bow down. So it's just a very powerful statement that, of course, can be seen in the Davidic monarchy, but also prophetically in the Messianic monarchy. The Lion of Judah. So, verse 9, the second verse of the blessing. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches. He lies down as a lion. And as a lion, who dares to rouse him up? Lots of cool things going on here. Wordplay. Really cool wordplays we're going to look at. Jacob compares the future victory and the ascendancy of Judah to a lion resting after a kill. Okay, that's the image. So again, you have this powerful, military, kingly kind of image. And so Jacob is saying Judah kind of rising to this level, not just individually, but the tribe of Judah, the descendants of Judah, rising to this level. It's like a lion resting after a kill. Judah's enemies are compared to the lion's slain prey. And there's a parallel prophecy in the book of Numbers, chapter 23, verse 24, in which it says, "The lion will not lie down until it devours the prey and drinks the blood of the slain." In the future to come, Judah will be at peace, and his enemy will be defeated, just as the lion slumbers after having its fill. Have you ever watched National Geographic specials on lions? After they have the kill, they're like the fat American. Okay, they're just like, they're stuffed, and they just kind of go and lay down and sleep. They're just like totally subdued. In the same way that none of the surviving animals around would dare to decide, "Hey, the lion's really full and taking a rest. Let's go around and frolic and play." Okay, they're probably looking at the carcass and thinking, "Yeah, you know, that could be us. No one messes with a lion, even when it's fat and sleepy." So what Jacob is saying, neither will any of the surviving nations dare to challenge Judah. Once Judah, especially through the Messiah, does what he does, it happened with David. David achieved peace because no one that had not been in battle with David dared to go into battle with David. And that's the way it's kind of describing Judah, that once everyone sees him in battle and sees how he wins, how definitive it is, none of the other surviving people are going to want to mess with him. Rashi explains the lion prophecies again, referring to the eras, the periods of King David and King Solomon. The lion tearing the prey is King David, who made war on Israel's enemies and subdued them. And the lion that's lying down to rest refers to the days of David's son, King Solomon, who enjoyed an era of peace and prosperity. As Scripture says in 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 25, "So Judah and Israel lived in safety, every man under his vine and his fig tree, from Dan even to Beersheba," meaning from the north to the south, if you know your geography, "all the days of Solomon." In other words, once they saw what Judah did, i.e. David, no one really messed with Solomon. Just as King David and Solomon, though, what's true of them, what's said of them, is true and can be said of the Messiah. They prefigure and foreshadow the Messiah and the wars of Messiah that's followed by the peace of Messiah. The lion prophecies also speak of the time of peace that will come after the wars of Messiah. When Messiah comes, he defeats the enemies of Israel. This total conquest will result in peace, during which no nation would dare to rise up again against Israel. The people of Israel will enjoy a time of unparalleled peace and prosperity, which is what we call the Messianic kingdom to come, the New Jerusalem. As the conquering hero who defeats Judah's enemies, the Messiah receives the title Lion of the Tribe of Judah. And that was our lesson this evening, our Hebrew lesson from Revelation 5, verse 5, where John wrote, "Stop weeping. Behold, the lion, the big one, that is from the tribe of Judah, the root of David." These messianic lion prophecies are also echoed in Balaam's prophecies. Remember good old Balaam? Balaam, who remembers Balaam? Who's Balaam? Yeah, he was kind of you could call him the magician, kind of, yeah. He was the Gentile Moses. The sages said he was just as righteous, just as smart, just as everything as Moses, except he was too quick to give over to his evil inclination. He was the backside of Moses. He was the one that tried to, you know, curse, because he knew. Remember, blessings and curses are prophetic destinies, and he was known that what he said happened. And so, like Moses, he knew how to use the names of Hashem and all of these things. But every time he went to do it, he gave a blessing instead, right? Now, I want you to compare these two seemingly, in English, identical passages. One is from this week's section, Genesis 49, verse 9. And the other is from the book of Numbers, Numbers 24, verse 9. Genesis 49, verse 9 says, "He couches, he lies down." The Hebrew word there is ravatz. He ravatzes as a lion, and as a lion who dares to rouse him up. Numbers 24, verse 9, he couches and he lies down as a lion. But it does not use the word ravatz. It uses the word shakav. He shakavs as a lion, and as a lion who dares to rouse him. Now, if you notice, even if you just are going by what I just said, that you can look again, Genesis 49, 9, Numbers 24, 9. In the English, those are exactly the same verse. They are exactly the same verse. And in Hebrew, they are exactly the same verse, except for the verb that is used for lying down. Genesis 49 uses ravatz. Numbers 24 uses shakav. Okay? Now, the two verses, as I said, would appear identical in English, but the Hebrew words translated "he lies down" are different. The Genesis 49 text uses ravatz, a word that indicates lying down, but also would indicate lying down in the sense of crouching, alert, and ready to pounce. The Numbers 24 uses shakav. It means to lie down, but more the lying down for a nap after Thanksgiving dinner. Okay? So both say the same thing in English. Both say lying down, but one is this lying down in the sense of ready to pounce on prey. The other is in the sense of lying down for a Sunday nap. Now, the sages, of course, because they knew their scriptures backwards and forwards, knew that these two verses were identical, except for the nuance of how the lion is lying down. And so that caused them to ponder. So the sages of the Midrash used the difference in the two words as a way of understanding about the rising and the falling of the fortunes of the tribe of Judah and the house of David. To help make the Midrash more intelligible, I'm going to read it to you, but I'm going to translate ravatz as crouched and shakav as snoozed, so that you'll pick up on the Hebrew wordplay. Okay? It's a wordplay that really only gets it in Hebrew, so I'm translating it. Ravatz is going to be crouched, shakav, snoozed. This is from a Midrash, Genesis Rabbah, 98:7. "And the lion of Judah, from Perez to David, he couches, he snoozes as a lion." It's quoting Numbers 24, verse 9. "But from David to Zedekiah," the last of the Judaic kings, he crouches down ravatz, like a lion. That's the Genesis 49 text. From Zedekiah to the Messiah, he couches, he snoozes, shakav, as a lion. And in this world, he couches, he snoozes as a lion. But in the Messianic age, he crouches down as a lion until the enemies are no more. Then when his enemies are defeated, he couches and snoozes as a lion. So it's kind of using the two identical verses to kind of describe the expansion and contraction, Kesedim and Gevurah, giving and the taking, masculine and the feminine, the constant ebb and flow of the divine will. And this is how it's relating to Judah in particular. So here is what it says kind of in English. From Perez to Judah, the monarchy would remain concealed, kind of like a sleeping lion. All there, but not really. From David to Zedekiah, when a Judean king from the line of David, from Judah, sat on the throne, it was like a wakeful lion, ready to pounce. But from Zedekiah to the Messiah, the days of the exile, the monarchy is once again concealed like a sleeping lion. In other words, the promise to David was you would forever have a throne. Well, right now, where is it? Well, the sages would argue it's sleeping. Okay, that's the verb shakaf. It's the lion, but it's sleeping. Okay, but when Messiah comes, it will then be the pouncing lion. And then after Messiah defeats his enemies, and the world is at peace, and the Messianic era is upon us, his throne will once again be like the sleeping lion. Okay, so that's the Lion of Judah. Sometimes he's pouncing, and sometimes he's snoozing. Sometimes he's revealed, sometimes he's concealed. And so Jacob is giving this powerful blessing, but within it is the notion that at times it's going to be concealed. And at other times, Judah is going to kick tail and take names. Everybody will know, everybody will fear, everybody will bow down to him, everybody will acknowledge his lordship. And then the other times, he still possesses that, but it's concealed. So the lion that crouches and the lion that snoozes. Okay. So it's a play on words that you only catch in the Hebrew. The tearing of my son, still in verse 9. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. So we've been examining this lion imagery of verse 9, but there is an additional sense in which this hints at Messiah, the Hebrew of this verse. The Hebrew of Genesis 49, verse 9, which the NASB translates as, from the prey, my son, you have gone up, could also be translated as, from the tearing apart of my son, you have ascended. Okay, it's a play on words, and you can translate it either way. The NASB is not incorrect. I think it's very literal, and which is most of the time why I like the NASB, because it is very literal. It's very wooden, but because of that, it's very accurate, at least on the Peshat level. On a Peshat level, it's about as accurate as you can get. But not everything is reflected in its fullness in that. And so, on a very wooden level, it means from the prey, my son, you've gone up. But from a deeper level, by taking the same words and kind of letting their meanings kind of flush themselves out, from the tearing, my son, you have ascended. And the Midrash likes this reading. The Midrash Rabbah 98:7 for Genesis reads it in this tearing way, suggesting that Joseph is the torn son of whom Jacob is speaking. And there is a messianic shadow that we've talked about with Joseph, right? He's ripped from his father. He's the favorite of his father. His brothers become jealous. He's ripped from him. He's devoured his clothes. He's sold. He's buried into the earth, comes out and sends into the nations. That whole beautiful shadow of the Messiah. Genesis Rabbah picks up on that Jacob is speaking about Joseph being torn away. But also, I think when we hear these words about Judah and his being this king and being this one that goes to battle, and then you read about him being torn, and after being torn, ascending. I mean, how can our thoughts not go to the crucifixion? And Yeshua's flesh being scourged, him being crucified, but then rising from the dead and ascending to his Father. It's as if the Father speaks to his Son through the voice of the Father Jacob, saying to his Son, "From the tearing, my Son, you have ascended." So just again there in the Hebrew, when, you know, this morning when I was reading it, it just kind of really grabbed me. It's a very powerful shadow of the crucifixion and his clothes and his body and his flesh being torn only so that he could ascend. So again, you have this ebb and flow. Judah's this great king. He's being prophesied to be this great king. But then there's also this tearing of him and this ripping of him. But that will result in his ascendancy. The Shevet, which was our verbal tally in Revelation 5, verse 5. Genesis 49, verse 10, it says, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah." So Jacob prophesies here, and again sets the prophetic destiny for Judah, that the monarchy, the kingdom of Israel, would arise from the line of Judah. The scepter shall not depart from Judah. When the Torah says the scepter will not depart from Judah, we are to understand the scepter as a symbol for kingship. The scepter represents a monarch's authority. But the Hebrew word that's being translated as scepter is shevet. And as with most Hebrew words, shevet is pregnant with meaning. Remember, Hebrew is a word-poor language. And so each word has to do a lot of different duties. And so each word comes with a lot of baggage, and shevet is one of those. I want to look at just two chief meanings of shevet. One is that it's commonly used to denote a staff, a rod, or some striking implement, but it's also the common word for tribe. The double meaning of the word works in the prophecy to imply that the royal status will not depart from the royal tribe of Judah. Recall how Judah used his staff in Genesis 38. He used it as collateral and as a token of his identity. Little foreshadowing there. Here's where Jacob is just brilliant with his word choice. He's pulling things from what he knows of them. Genesis 38, Judah used his staff, his shevet, as collateral and a token of his identity. In Genesis 38:25, the sages understood Judah's staff as alluding to, and I quote from the Midrash, to the King Messiah. As it says, quoting Psalm 110, verse 24, "The Lord will stretch forth your scepter, staff, shevet, from Zion, saying, rule in the midst of your enemies." The Midrash Rabbah and the Targum Yonatan also connect the shevet of Judah that's described here in verse 10 of Genesis 49 with the Messiah. Again from the Midrash, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah." This refers to the throne of kingship, as it is written, quoting Psalm 45:61, "Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. A scepter, a shevet of uprightness, is the scepter of your kingdom." When will that happen? It will happen when the Messiah comes. And here is how the Targum Yonatan, translates slash paraphrases Genesis 49, verse 10. "Kings and rulers shall not cease from those of the house of Judah." That's how it renders the verse. And there are several messianic passages that employ this scepter image, this shevet image. For example, the often quoted messianic Psalm chapter 2 says of the Messiah in verse 9, "You shall break them with a rod, shevet of iron. You shall shatter them like earthenware." The book of Revelation quotes this passage and applies it to the Messiah, explaining that the iron scepter is a symbol for the authority the Messiah has received from the Father. Revelation 12:5. Therein, Messiah is referred to as the male child, who is to rule all the nations with the shevet of iron. Therefore, the rod of iron is understood as a title for Messiah, denoting his authority over all the nations. So he's not just going to have authority over the sons of Israel, but over all the nations. When used in this sense, shevet is seen as a sort of cudgel for smiting, an instrument for punishment and retribution. Similarly, Psalm 89, verse 32, the Lord declares of the wicked, "Then I will punish their transgressions with the rod and their iniquity with stripes," with the shevet. In the book of Proverbs, the shevet is what's used to correct fools. Just a quick sampling, Proverbs 13:24, Proverbs 22:15, Proverbs 23:14, Proverbs 29:15, but to name a sampling of where Proverbs uses shevet as this correcting tool. So you have now an image from a messianic point of view that Jacob is giving to Judah, this scepter that doesn't just represent his kingship and his authority and his lordship, but it's what enables him to judge. It's what enables him to set things right, to correct, to realign. That's what's being passed on here. So the shevet of Messiah is not only an instrument of retribution and punishment, it's the instrument of realignment. But there's even more. In Psalm 23, oh yes, the shevet of the good shepherd is an instrument of comfort to the flock. For it is with the shevet that he drives off predators. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me, for your shevet and your staff comfort me. The prophet Ezekiel also employs this shevet imagery when he depicts a shepherd counting and sorting his flock by passing them underneath his shevet. Ezekiel 20, verse 37. I will make you pass under the rod, the shevet, and I will bring you into the bond of the covenant. So it's also shepherding motif. Okay? The staff of the shepherd. The shevet of Messiah is his authority. It's his authority over not only his brothers, but over the nations. It's the implement of his retribution. It's the implement of his conquering at Gog and Magog. But it's also what he uses to realign. It's also the comfort that he brings with all those beautiful things of Psalm 23. The flock that is under his care is a comfort and the entrance into the bond of the covenant. According to the prophet Isaiah, the shevet of Messiah is none other than the word that he speaks. He speaks of the shevet of his mouth, striking the earth and slaying the wicked. This is Isaiah chapter 11, verse 4. But with righteousness he will judge the poor. So with this sense of purity and charity, because Zedek, righteousness, means charity. So with charity, he's going to realign the poor. He will decide with fairness for the afflicted of the earth. And he will strike the earth with the shevet of his mouth. And with the breath of his lips, he will slay the wicked. So one of the more powerful quotes of Hasidic understanding of the Messiah that I appreciate, it's based on passages like this in Isaiah 11, that when Messiah comes and he does all of this Gog and Magog stuff, that he will conquer the world without firing a single bullet. He will do it solely through his mouth, solely through his words. And so it really, a few years ago, reading Isaiah and reading some of the commentary on it and beginning to realize that it really made me rethink into the world stuff, okay, so to speak. It really may not be nuclear war. It's going to be something we don't expect. We expect nuclear war. We expect death. We expect billions of people dying. What we don't expect is someone showing up on the scene and changing the world solely with the shevet of his mouth, the sword of his mouth. Messiah will conquer the world without firing a single bullet. Isaiah's image of the Messiah slaying the wicked, but doing it with his mouth, is echoed by Paul. 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 8. Paul tells us that the Torah-less one, that's his term for the Antichrist, the one that does not do Torah, will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end the appearance of his coming. So Paul himself tends to have this idea. How will the Torah-less one be, the lawless one? See how different lawlessness means when it means without Torah? So the Antichrist will be one who tries to teach the church Torah is useless. And how will he be overcome? How will he be the one who comes and sits in the church, sits in a religious seat, teaching his people not to do Torah? How will he be defeated? By the word, the breath of the Messiah. It's Isaiah, but it's also Paul quoting Isaiah. So again, makes you rethink some things. And it makes you think, wow, have we been guilty of literalizing metaphor? Now think about all the metaphors we use for speech. He was breathing fire, right? He was spitting darts. Right? We have all kinds of ways of describing speech that are very combative. And then if we go back to some of our previous lessons, what is Lashon Hara? Evil speech and gossip and so forth. Do you remember what is the sages taught? And then we found out not only the sages, but Yeshua taught it in the Gospels. What's worse than murder? Lashon Hara, because it's continual murder. You murder the same person over and over. Every time if I speak badly of you to this person, every time that person retells the story, it's killing them all over again. And it's not only killing them, it's killing the person who told it, the person who heard it, the person who hears it the next time. It's always associated with murder. But it's not murder, literally. So when you get into this understanding that the Shevet of the Messiah is really his breath, his words, and his teaching. And that's what's going to conquer the anti-Messiah. Gives you some pause to look at some text again. The same apocalyptic expectation is repeated in Revelation 19:15, just in case you got to have it there too, where Messiah is depicted as striking down the nations with a sharp sword coming from his mouth and ruling over them with a shevet of iron. Quoting again those Psalms I've already mentioned. Revelation 19, verse 15. From his mouth comes a sharp sword, so that with it he may strike down the nations, and he will rule them with a shevet of iron, and he treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God the Almighty. So all of this makes it clear that the shevet imagery is very much associated with Messiah. And going back to our Torah portion, to say that the Shevet will not depart from Judah is the same as saying that the Messianic office belongs to Judah. The Septuagint of the Torah translates it as an idiom, and it simply says, a ruler will not fail from Judah. The meaning of Jacob's prophecy is that the kings of Israel were destined to come from Judah, and the right to the throne was to remain with Judah, and therefore the Messiah, the ultimate king of Israel, must come from the line of Judah as well. There are some other neat things you can do here. We won't, but you can. Is the association with scepter and staff. And you begin to understand staff, the shepherd's staff, and Moses' staff, that those are the Hebrew words that get translated into the Greek, that get translated into English as cross. Okay. So part of how the Messiah overcomes is the cross. His word and his cross. The ruler's staff. Still in verse 10, the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. The word that the NASB is translating as ruler staff is an unusual Hebrew word, nechokek. Comes from the verbal root kakak, C-H-A-K-A-K, which means to inscribe. Nechokek would be referring probably to something like an inscribed staff, an emblem of tribal leadership that signifies power and authority. But it also carries the sense of the lawgiver, and that laws were scribed on things like this at the time the Bible was written in stone, as it were, in our language. The Hebrew word for statute, you know, your laws, your ordinances, and your statutes, is chok, coming from the same verbal root. In Isaiah 33, verse 22, "For the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver," mechokek. Proverbs 8, verse 15, "Wisdom declares, for by me kings reign and rulers decree," kakach, justice. The ruler's staff might have been a special inscribed staff that betokened a leader with the authority to make laws. At the very least, it is clear that the word implies legal authority. The Septuagint doesn't even attempt to translate this obscure Hebrew word. It knows it's a bizarre word, and so it instead offers a paraphrase, and it uses the word prince. Targum Yonatan translates it as teacher of the Torah. All of these, which one do we pick, right? Does it mean lawgiver? Does it mean the inscription of the law on that the lawgiver holds? Does it mean that the one who holds it's the prince? Does it mean that it's a teacher of Torah? I think we can agree, hey, they all work, right? They all pretty well describe Messiah to a T. He is the token of God's legal authority. He is the lawgiver, and that he is the arbitrator of the Torah, and he is the second Moses. He is the teacher of Torah. He is the prince promised to arise from Judah. But what does it mean that the ruler's staff will not depart from between his feet? Now you're going to learn a little more Hebrew. Hebrew kind of shied away from talking about private parts. And so it used euphemisms. Right? What are euphemisms? Something like the ladies need to go powder their nose. But they're not bringing any powder, Mama. Feet is a euphemism for the male reproductive organ. With two, they cover their eyes. With two, they cover their feet. They were being modest. Okay? It's a euphemism. And so by saying that it will not depart from his feet, it's a parallel. The scepter will not depart from Judah, and the ruler's staff will not depart from the descendants, you know, coming from the male part. Okay, that's what's going on. The Septuagint picked up on that, and it actually translated it as sexual potency. So Judah will apparently be popping out royalty left and right, in other words. Hence the translation, "A ruler shall not fail from Judah, nor a prince from his loins." That's how the Septuagint deals with it. It translates it as loins. In other words, the kings of Israel will be descendants of Judah. They will always come from his loins. Which describes also shadow of Messiah. That's incarnational stuff there. Genesis 49, verse 10, still hanging in that verse. "The scepter shall not depart from Judah. The ruler's staff will be from his loins until Shiloh comes," or Shiloh comes. So we understand the scepter and the ruler's staff as the monarchy of the house of David over the people of Israel, as the Messiah's authority, as the one who interprets and arbitrates Torah. But the verse goes on to say that the right to the monarchy shall not depart from Judah until Shiloh comes. What's Jacob getting at? What does this mean? Who or what is Shiloh? Now this, my friends, the sages spent volumes on who is Shiloh or what is Shiloh. So, data dump. I'm going to give you a short 4 or 5 handfuls of understandings of Shiloh. Okay? The meaning of the phrase, until Shiloh comes. One of the things that is universal is that it is a reference to Messiah. No debate on that. Never has been a debate on that. Before, during, after the time of Yeshua, always known this was a messianic passage. In fact, this passage is regarded as a primary proof text for the Messiah from the Torah, whether you're Christian or Jewish. For example, one school of Talmudic thought understood Shiloh as the name of Messiah. This is from Tractate Sanhedrin 98b, and it says, "What is the Messiah's name?" The school of Rabbi Shila, which is sounds a lot like Shiloh, doesn't it? In fact, it is. Rabbi Shiloh says, "Well, his name is Shiloh, as it is written," quoting Genesis 49:10, "until Shiloh comes." Now, what I like about that particular tractate is it goes on for like a whole page. Well, Rabbi Hillel says the Messiah's name is Hillel, and Rabbi Gamaliel says this Messiah's name is Gamaliel. It's a really powerful teaching in that you're supposed to be attached to a teacher so close to the Messiah that that's how you see Messiah, through your teacher. But it's just kind of funny. Rabbi Shiloh says, "Well, his name's Shiloh. It says right there in the Bible, right?" Now, the Targum, Onkelos, Vav Onkelos, he paraphrases it saying, he does not, this is how the verse runs for him. It does not say until Shiloh comes in the Targum Onkelos. It says until the Messiah comes, for his is the kingdom. So he paraphrases it. And remember, this was the paraphrase read at the time of Yeshua in the synagogues. So again, clearly understood as Messiah. He just kind of, as the Targums do, remove the difficulty. If we leave Shiloh in there, people are going to be asking, who's Shiloh? What is Shiloh? And it ends up in these multi-volume debates. We're just going to put, until the Messiah comes, for his is the kingdom. And so all of those who were kind of the pew warmers in the synagogue, they just got the facts. Okay. Targum Yonatan, another Targum, says, until the time of Messiah, the youngest of Judah's sons. So the Targum Yonatan preserves a tradition that Shiloh was a son of Judah. And Jacob was predicting that at the time of Shiloh, that would be the Messianic era. Genesis Rabbah says Shiloh alludes to the Messiah king. Rashi follows the same line of thought, explaining Shiloh to be a title for the Messiah, but then he goes on to report an interesting explanation for the word Shiloh. This is from Rashi. A Midrashic explanation understands the word Shiloh as a contraction of two words, Shei, S-H-E-I, which means a gift of homage, and Lo, L-O, which means to him. As it says, Psalm 76:11, let all who are around him bring gifts to him who is to be feared. So Shiloh, Rashi saw as a title, meaning the one that you bring gifts of homage to because you fear him. I think you can see some nice messianic shadows there too. Alternatively, the great Torah commentator Sforno understood the word Shiloh to be related to the word Shalom, indicating that the Messiah would bring the era of universal peace. The Midrash Tanakhuma, most of the time when I quote Midrash, it's Midrash Rabbah. Another little nugget is the Midrash Tanakhuma. It preserves the opinion that Shiloh is related to the Hebrew word Shiyah, which means the birth sac, indicating that the Messiah would be born of a woman. The Septuagint translates the phrase until Shiloh comes as, quote, the thing stored up for him. Not sure where the Septuagint's going. But the hymn is clearly the Messiah. Things stored up for him would be the right to the throne, the authority to the nations, all that stuff that comes with the Shevet and all of that. Therefore, the passage indicates that the Davidic kingly line will not be exhausted until King Messiah comes and receives all that is prophesied or all that belongs to him. Despite the widely divergent explanations of the word Shiloh, every commentator agrees that the term denotes the Messiah. Rabbi Rachmiel Friedlin, who was an Orthodox yeshiva-trained individual who became a believer, actually comments that he sees an echo of the Shiloh prophecy in Ezekiel's prophecy against a corrupt Davidic monarchy. And this is from Ezekiel 21, beginning in verse 25. "And you, O slain wicked one, the prince of Israel, whose day has come, and the time of the punishment of the end, thus says the Lord God, remove the turban and take off your crown. This will no longer be the same. Exalt that which is low and abase that which is high. Ruin, a ruin, a ruin I will make it. This also will be no more until he comes whose right it is, and I will give it to him." Yeshua alludes to this Ezekiel prophecy when he says, "For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and everyone who humbles himself will be exalted," Luke 14:11. Friedland notes that the prophet Ezekiel seems to refer to the scepter prophecy to the term Shiloh. In the Ezekiel passage, the Davidic king, who is Zedekiah, by the way, is abased and humbled, and the Davidic dynasty is ruined until the rise of the Messiah, whose right it is to take it back. The prophecy indicates that subsequent to Ezekiel's time, the Babylonian deportation, there would be no Davidic king occupying the throne until the rise of King Messiah. To put it another way, even though the monarchy vanishes in Ezekiel's day, the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh, the Messiah, comes. It should also be plain to us the phrase, "the scepter shall not depart from Judah until Shiloh comes," does not mean that it will depart from Judah when Shiloh comes. Here the word "until" carries with it a sense of having an endpoint in mind, such as when Yeshua says that all the prophets in the Torah prophesied until John. It didn't mean they were then useless. So we understand the passage to mean that the scepter does not depart from Judah because Shiloh comes and makes it permanent. And what you can do with Shiloh is you can look at all the different Hebrew words that the sages say it comes from. I gave you just a little sampling of the argument that's contained in massive volumes. But it's all centering on the idea of the Messiah and that there would be this intermediate time where no Messiah was, no Davidic king, when it seems as if God is kind of hidden and Israel's struggling and they're being persecuted and they're in exile, and it just seems like all the promises that Jacob made, all the promises that God made to his people are just garbage, that there would be this time, but then there would be this time of Shiloh, and that would be the time of the Messiah. That's kind of the crux of the arguments. They just get really nuanced. The obedience of the people, still in verse 10, "The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples." The Hebrew for the last phrase is, guess what? Bizarre, like everything else in these blessings. The NASB renders it, "to him shall be the obedience of the peoples." Rashi renders it as, "his will be a gathering of the nations." The Septuagint translates it as, "he is the expectation of the nations." Targum Yonatan reads it as, "because of whom people will pine away." The Midrash Rabbah gives two meanings. "To him shall be the obedience of the people." The Messiah will come and set on the edge the teeth of the nations of the world. For it says, Micah 7:16, "nations will see and be ashamed of all their might, and they will put their hand on their mouth, and their ears will be deaf." And then the other one that the Midrash gives, "him to whom the nations of the world will flock. Then in the days the nations will resort to the root of Jesse, who will stand as a signal for the peoples, and his resting place will be glorious." So what is all of that, right? Well, how do we interpret this verse, this part of the verse? All of the interpretations, again, all apply equally well to Yeshua, to Messiah. When the Son of Man comes in His glory and all the angels with Him, then He will sit on His glorious throne and all the nations will be gathered before Him. Matthew 25, verse 31. Sounds like the Midrashers understanding. Nations will see Him and be ashamed. To Him shall be the obedience of the people. Until that day, He is the hopeful expectation of the nations. As the Scripture says, and the coastlands wait expectingly for His Torah. Isaiah 42, 4. Until then, we are like the Septuagint, and we pine for Him. It is easy to see how the prophecy is already being fulfilled in Yeshua. Ever since the days of the apostles, faith in Yeshua has spread to the nations. He is the signal for the peoples to which they flock. Men and women from every land, every country, cast allegiance with Him. And through Him, the Torah goes out even to the most distant coastlands. His followers are a gathering of the nations. Another Midrash's interpretation. So, which is it? Again, it's kind of all of them. It's just describing the role of the Messiah, bringing all nations under His authority. Then Jacob still gets crazy. Verse 11. He ties his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. Yeah. There's a reason why he brings in the donkey that we won't discuss. It's kind of Jacob being cute the way he was earlier in one of the... But Jacob continues to bless his son Judah, and he says he ties his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to a choice vine. Now here, on a Peshat level, you just have a blessing for agricultural prosperity. Meaning the grapevines will be hardy and thick enough to serve as a hitching post. Kind of just a nice little blessing of, hey, you know, may your vineyards, because that's one of their major crops that they made their living on, may your vineyards be, you know, so hardy that you can tie your horses up to them. Now, from a messianic perspective, any mention of a donkey is going to bring us to Zechariah 9, verse 9. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout in triumph, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. Your king, Judah, is coming to you. He is just and endowed with salvation, humble and mounted on a donkey, even on a colt, the foal of a donkey. Bet you thought that was a New Testament passage, didn't you? The Midrash seems to pick up on this connection as well. Listen to the Midrash. He ties his donkey's colt to the choice vine. This alludes to the one that is written of in Zechariah 9, humble and mounted on a donkey, even on a colt, the foal of a donkey. And it's on the strength of Zechariah 9:9 that the sages reckon that every time a donkey is mentioned in the Scriptures, it's a reference to Messiah. It's a little interpretation nugget for you. Every time a donkey is mentioned, it has an allusion to the Messiah. And go back to Balaam, the Antichrist of his generation, who kept befuddling the Antichrist with his words. The donkey. Okay? So, this is kind of neat. So when Yeshua enters the city of Jerusalem riding on a donkey, everyone immediately associates it with Zechariah 9. His entry on a donkey was an open statement declaring, I am he to whom the prophet referred. Thus the foal and the donkey's colt of the tribe of Judah is the messianic expectation, the steed that carries Messiah to Jerusalem. But what does it mean that he ties his donkey to a choice vine? Beyond the Peshat again of that you'd be blessed and be fertile and all of that. But think of it in a messianic shadow way. Yeshua, one of his titles is the vine. As he says in John 15:5, I am the vine. He is the choice vine to which we tether ourselves with our messianic expectation. Verse 11, he washes his garments in wine and his robes in the blood of grapes. Again, here is just a more, on a Peshat level, blessings of abundance, providence. That is, you will produce such hardy vines that they will be sufficient for tethering animals, and what is more, the wine will be in such abundance, it will be as common as laundry water. Hence, he washes his garments in wine. And there are prophecies that relate to the Messianic age here. Several places in rabbinic literature, kind of like with the donkey, whenever you come across wine, you're in the Messianic era. Okay, wine is a key symbol for that. And the Messianic era is often described as having this abundance of wine. The image is something like the streets of gold in the New Jerusalem, which is to say it will be so common as pavement. But this helps us understand the water-to-wine incident in John 2. At the wedding in Cana, Yeshua's mother complains to her son that the wine supply is exhausted. And he replies, protesting, "My hour has not yet come." The implication is that the hour of the Son of Man, when wine will be as common as water, had not yet arrived. Nevertheless, he changes the water to wine, a miracle John refers to as the beginning of his signs, the beginning of his manifestation. It's a foretaste of the feast to come. So washing his garments in wine, it's a foreshadow of the Messianic era, where the wine will be as common as water, the joy, wine and joy. The image of Yeshua with his garments washed in wine, his robes in the blood of grapes, again, has several parallels. We recall how Joseph's brothers dipped his robe in blood. In Isaiah, we see Messiah coming forth from Edom with apparel red and garments like the one who treads in the winepress. Targum Yonatan elaborates on this warrior Messiah theme, drawing on Isaiah 63. Turn in your Bibles to Genesis 49:3, because I want you to look at what your English says. And then I'm going to read to you what the Targum says. This is how the Targum, if you were an Aramaic speaker in the first century going to synagogue with Yeshua and you didn't speak Hebrew, and they read Genesis 49:11 in Hebrew, and you looked around and said, "What did he just say?" This is what they would have said. "How beautiful is the King Messiah, who's to arise from among those of the house of Judah. He girds his loins and comes down, arranging battle lines against his enemy, and slaying kings together with their rulers. And there is no king or ruler who can withstand him. He makes the mountains red with the blood of the slain. His garments are rolled in blood, and he is like the presser of grapes." It's kind of like when you watch the UN and they have a translator, and you're always wondering, is the translator really saying what the other person's saying? Or is the translator giving you like a whole different line? Okay, that was a lot of words. It's not right, but you get the paraphrase. In fact, that Targum there on verse 11 it's a nice summary of the whole section of Judah's blessings. In the book of Revelation, Messiah comes clothed with a robe dripped in blood, Revelation 19:13. And the saints are those who have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb, 7:14. The term blood of grapes is a poetic idiom for wine. At his last Seder with his disciples, he reverses the metaphor, declaring a cup of wine to be his blood, the blood of the covenant. Darker than wine, whiter than milk. His eyes, verse 12, are dull from wine, and his teeth white from milk. That's obvious what that means, right? Of course, right? We say that all the time. That's the NIV renders it as, his eyes will be darker than wine, his teeth whiter than milk. This is actually pretty close to the sense of the Hebrew, but the NASB renders it that Judah's eye will be dark from the abundance of wine in those days, and his teeth will be white from the abundance of milk. So again, more kind of prosperity blessings, but it has a deeper level. It's implying that the Messianic age, the Messianic kingdom, will be a time of great plenty. The juxtaposition of the red wine and the white milk does not escape the notice of the sages. It was odd to them, too. This is from the Midrash. His eyes are dull from wine. From this you should learn that that wine will be abundant in Messiah's territory. And his teeth are white from milk. For the sake of the Torah, it says in Isaiah 1:18, though your sins are as scarlet, they will be as white as snow. And though they are red like crimson, they shall be like wool. The dark eyes and the white teeth, it could even be a physical description. Akin to what Solomon describes in Song of Songs. Targum Yonatan understands it as a physical description. Okay, again, look at your English Bibles to verse 12. And I'm going to read to you the UN translator's version. How beautiful are the eyes of King Messiah. They are like pure wine, for they have not seen the uncovering of nakedness or the shedding of innocent blood. And his teeth are whiter than milk, because he has not eaten what has been robbed or taken by force. And his mountains and his press will be red from wine, and his hills white from the harvest and from the flocks. Yeah, I love the Targum statue. And then finally, the bookend, Genesis 49, verse 18, Jacob says, "For your salvation I wait, O Lord." I actually won't cover this because we would be here for a while. I'm just going to mention that the Hebrew word for salvation there is Yeshua. And so he begins the blessings by saying, I've seen it all. I've been given this vision like Yochanan. I've seen it all, and now I'm going to tell you what's going to happen at the end. Then he blesses his sons and gives them their prophetic destinies. And then he concludes it with, "For Yeshua, I wait. For Yeshua, I wait." What's interesting is that's not only part of the prayer, the Amidah, that's prayed three times a day. That part of the prayer sounds like this. "May you cause the branch of David your servant to sprout forth quickly, whose horn will be raised with your salvation, Yeshua. For we hope for your salvation, Yeshua, all day long. Blessed are you, Lord, who causes this horn of salvation to sprout forth." So they pray that three times a day, and in that prayer three times is listed a prayer for Yeshua. So that's nine. And Genesis 49, verse 18 is said three times if you do the prayer offices. Before you go to bed, there's a little short set of prayers you say. And you say that three times in Hebrew. But you say it three times in Hebrew, each time switching the word order of the number of Hebrew words in there. So it's, "For Yeshua, I wait all day. All day I wait for Yeshua. Today I wait for Yeshua." It kind of, so nine times three. So that's 27 plus, that's 36 times a typical Jew every day literally says the words, "I wait for Yeshua, I want to see Yeshua." Back that into last week's discussion. Ani Yosef. Okay, so I told you it was long. Just lots of data. Just a couple of key nuggets to take with you. Blessings in the Torah are prophetic destinies. That's why when someone blesses you or when you're blessed by someone, you need to clear your mind. You don't just need to, yeah, whatever. You need to, if someone says, "Can I bless you?" or you say, "Will you bless me?" You need to get your mind ready because it's doing something. Blessings do something. So it's prophetic destiny. And then within that, I think the wordplay with Shevet and lion and the contraction, the hiding, the revealing, very powerful stuff in there. And that universally, these five verses in Genesis 49, 8 through 12, universally are messianic. So when you're reading those five verses, you really need to put on the Jesus goggles, if you will. They're heavily messianic. Volumes, 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 written before, they weren't written down, they were oral, but were existing before Yeshua came on these texts. So these texts would have been informing the expectation of the Messiah at the time of the apostles. I kind of tried to bring out some of those. So just know that a lot's packed in there. Okay? All right, let us close with a blessing. Baruch atah Adonai, notain ha-Torah. Blessed are you, Lord, the giver of the Torah. Amen.